to order and ask for the roll call.
Okay, Ray DeAnda.
Here.
Jim DeMartini.
Here.
Wes Hall.
Here.
Darren Garrett.
Here.
Gordon Ford.
Here.
Clarence Willman.
Here.
Mike Lynch.
Here.
Ron Martin. Linda Stoss Burnett.
Here.
Okay. Mike Fisher, I'm sorry.
Okay. Let's see, under announcements, a couple of things. First of all, I'll do an announcement first. We have some strong opinions. Let's try to keep to issues, not people. we have a phone call from Paul, which will be only till 2:30 today. So we have to move some things on the agenda. We're going to be moving item 9 up after 5. And apparently we're moving 10A up to be taken after 6. We'll get to that. Public comment, I have to read this section here. Any member of the public may wish to speak on any items, which is, I'm sorry, I have to allow other members to make announcements. Any announcements?
Just real briefly, the investment manager's proxy voting reports for January to March 2009 are available for viewing at the Stancer office.
Sorry.
Okay. public comment, again, any member of the public may speak on item which is on the agenda. The board will only allow comments by members of the public on any item on the agenda during consideration of the item. When the item is called, please raise your hand or fill out a form, as people have done, so I can recognize you. The general public at the beginning of the regular session public comment period may address the matters of jurisdiction of the board and up with the agenda. However, any person wishing to make a presentation must be in written copies. Presentations are limited to 3 minutes. We have one person who wishes to speak under general. Pat?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you. Well, I read with dismay in the newspaper that the administrator has submitted his resignation. And I would like to encourage the board members to not accept his resignation. And the reason is, as a manager of Stanislaus County, I spent a number of years working with other departments to hire management staff. And these are some of the qualities we looked for when we were hiring people. We're looking for someone with experience, knowledge, intelligence, someone who is organized, had leadership skills, integrity, and honesty. I think you already have that. Good Tom Watson.
Okay.
Hi, Paul. It's Michelle from Stanford. I'm going to put you on a speakerphone, okay?
Yes.
All righty. I hope it works.
Wait a minute.
Hello?
Yes.
Okay.
We can hear you.
We have... You submitted one, but it had an item on it.
Yeah, more than one item.
I'm sorry. Okay. My mistake. Let's do that real quick. Who do we have here? Lynn? Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Lynn Betancourt, retiree, former board member. And I was here when Tom was originally hired for the board as by the county. That is, he was elected as treasurer. And at that time, the county treasurer was the position on the board was important too. Tom knows the history of this organization, and I have supported Tom all along. I still do. I think he's a very honorable man. I am disappointed in him only that he resigned. I think a lot of pressure has been put on him that's inordinate and inappropriate. He has enough pressure on him from just his internal working authority. Does his business. When I went to my union to get him supported as a Republican, it's not a pay. I know his office was not a nonpartisan office, but I went to my union to support him, and I did that because he was nonpartisan. He was a fair man. He came from an honorable background of being a bean counter, an accountant, and he didn't give a rip about trying to have power here. One of his predecessors, not his immediate predecessor, but one before that, was a power-hungry man. to urge him to rescind his letter of resignation, and I'd like this board to reject it. It's the best interest of the community. He's done a fine job, and they disagree with something he's done here or there. But you know what? Look at it on the long shot. He's put in years and years. He put in a whole career as a treasurer, and then he resigned that position just to take this job. This was half his job. He was getting paid a salary for being treasurer. He didn't have to do the job. He could have kicked it down the road and said, "Nah, I'm good." And in fact, he resigned that position, which resulted in us getting a new treasurer and a new board member. And then Tom came over here, and we got him full time. It's amazing. It was wonderful. So I've used up my 3 minutes, but I think you really ought to reconsider that situation. And if anything, just postpone it for 6 months. See how he does.
Gary?
Mr. Poore, I'm Gary Hales. I have a question on the agenda as to where I should speak. I want to speak regarding the retirement board giving money back to the county, the $60 million or so, whatever it was.
Is that on the agenda somewhere, or is he speaking for
I'm not sure where it was. I put down the general.
So go ahead.
Is this?
You've got 3 minutes at this time.
Okay. Gary Hales. Has the action already been taken? If it has, I'd ask this board to reconsider it. It's my feeling or belief that the funds that we had to set aside for non-vested benefits had already been split with the county a long time ago. Now the county has a shortfall, and I believe last time we were talking it was around 22 million, 23. But basically what they're asking for is they want all the fun, the whole kit and caboodle. And to give $60 million plus or whatever it is over to them, it won't stop there. I believe next year they'll be right back, or even before next year. They want it. It's not just raiding the hen house and getting a few eggs. They want the whole hen house, so it's not going to stop. I believe the retirement board has a fiduciary duty to look out for the interests of the retirement fund, and I don't believe this is doing it. I believe that, in a sense, we're being robbed of the money that we had always split with them, and now they just want the rest of it. A lot of that fund was invested so that we could keep non-vested funds going, or benefits going, or whatever, but we earned money on that when there were the good times. Well, it's a bad time now, but it certainly doesn't call for giving everything up. They want to blame everything on us. They came at the beginning saying, "We want you to cooperate and be a partner with us." Well, I don't see this as, I see this being one-sided. It's not going to stop with that $60 million. They're going to want the rest of it. And as a board, I don't think you're doing your duty to just give it over. I think you should reconsider that more. I hope you'll give that some thought. Thank you.
Okay, Michael?
Michael O'Neill, President of RESCO, and I just want to follow up what Lynn and Pat have already said. RESCO had we just wanted to express to this board that Tom has RESCO's full support and backing. Although I mentioned this to Tom, I understand that he would love to join our ranks and just have a check mailed to him every month. I can certainly understand that, but we really appreciate working with Tom. He's, as Lynn has said, he's a man of integrity, honesty, and fairness, and he's been really good for RESCO to work with. Anywhere he can help us, he can, and give us direction, and it's been a pleasure to work with him. We hate to see this board and the county lose him as a resource. It's already been stated. He has many, many years of experience and a wealth of knowledge, and we would be a poor board without it.
I think I've been called on everybody that had public commentary time. So we move on to consent items. Anybody wish to pull an item on the consent calendar, or do I maintain a motion to
vote? I'd like to make a motion to approve the consent file.
Second.
Moved and seconded. Any comment? Nick. Call for a vote. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, we now move on to item number 9, which is discussing action of Barclays Global Investment. As I understand it, Deidre has raised some concerns. I have a written statement from Paul.
Yes.
Paul, you're there, and in your written statement, you say you understand some of the concerns, and as I read it correctly, the funding of BGI can be placed on hold. Is that what you stated?
Yeah, I think that's correct, Gordon. Hopefully everyone can hear me. It appears that the part of the $55 million rebalancing out of fixed income that was approved by this board in late March, $20 million was not going to BGI. It was going to existing managers, Legato, $10 million, Delaware, $5 million, Illumis Sales, $5 million. And it appears that was done yesterday. So the remaining $35 million out of Dodge and Cox into Barclays, I think there are two main issues or concerns. One is the pending potential rumored sale of BGI, which initially was just the iShare part, but now it appears more likely that the whole investment management firm could be part of a transaction. And the way the deal was structured in selling the iShare part, which had previously been announced, was that Barclays could shop around for other better deals by, I think, June 18th, which is fast approaching. So if there is going to be a deal selling the investment management arm of Barclays North America, it should be done in short order by that June 18th deadline. So that's one issue. The other issue, main issue, deals with security lending. Barclays, like many other index providers, including the Mellon S&P 500 index that we are currently invested in on a passive basis, does perform security lending bring in income, which is split between the index provider and the client, and generally it's a 50-50 split. And as we know from the custodian side and the security lending that we do with all our managers, there have been many issues on the security lending side where the value of the collateral pool that is invested has gone below the, on a market basis, has gone below the par value of those fixed income instruments that make up the collateral pool. I think given the uncertainty of the sale, number one, and two, security lending, although I am not that much concerned going forward because I think the cat's out of the bag and all the potential losses from security lending up to this point have already been realized and will be coming in to an environment where the collateral pool is, you know, by those running the collateral pool are very conservatively run as a reaction to the environment. But we can explore other options also, i.e. a non-security lending pool for a Russell Top 200 Value Index. That said, I'm pretty sure Barclays probably doesn't provide that, and that may not exist. I think the third thing is just timing. Back at the end of March, the markets were much, much lower. The markets have rallied almost 40% off the March 9th lows. And we, throughout this process, have, you know, in rebalancing and the timing of it, have missed that huge move in the equity market. So my sense of urgency is not as great today as it was back in March when we approved the rebalancing. The $20 million of the $55 has finally been done, and the remaining $35 million, I think we can put, as I wrote in my memo, on the agenda at the end of March when I appear there to discuss and get more answers on the Barclays potential rumored sale and more answers on the security lending. So that would be my recommendation. The other...
So, Paul, on this item, then you're saying you recommend it be on hold?
Yes, that's correct, Gordon.
Okay, can we see the questions from the board
members?
Yeah,
I have one question. I understand that recommendation, Paul, and I defer to you on that. But my question is, on the other $20 million, what was the issue that made us wait from March until yesterday?
That's a great question, Mike, and I don't have the answer to that. There's no reason that couldn't have been done almost immediately. And I think it brings up an issue which I bring up in this memo. Now, I've talked about, and that's just the whole process, and there... and I'm one of the parties involved, so I can be part of the blame here. But
we have a lot of, Paul,
I think we need to, between all parties, better communicate.
Hello. You have a lot of issues, but they're not the one on the agenda. I want to try and deal with the one on the agenda.
Yeah. Okay, I won't talk then.
I want to try and, we're short on time with you, and I want to make sure we deal with the agenda item first.
Okay. The short answer, Mike, is I'm not sure why that wasn't done immediately.
And I agree that we could have done that. From my perspective, I had bundled the whole $55 million as one rebalancing, and BGI was part of that. But clearly we could have broken it apart and done the $20 million with the current managers back in the end of March or the beginning of April. That could have been done early. So my mistake, my error. If the board needs to hear that, it's on me, because that clearly could have been done. We had the current managers on board, and in my mind, it was a whole, I was taking the board action as a $55 million bundle, and we were going to do BGI and the other managers, and the BGI contract had not been finalized yet, so we were pending that. But it could
Did the other three require a contract, too?
Could have been. No, okay. No, the other ones are ready to go. It could have been done.
Thanks, Tom.
If I could just kind of go back to the thing, I think the least amount of time we should focus on here is blame, because at this point we have a concern as to how the process went forward, but or didn't go forward. But in the future, we can address that going forward in terms of how these things need to be addressed, and that's something that we need to discuss with Paul, our administrator, and county council, or our council, so that we can come up with a. In the next circumstance, a very firm policy on how we want to proceed, because we should not be playing what I consider these blame games, because at this point, I'm not worried about that. I'm worried about making sure we're making the investments when we need to make them. So that's my comment, but we do need to, at some point, sit down and say, okay, what is it that we're looking for from these individuals?
Okay, our item is discussion action on Barclays Global Investors contract. So I need any board concerns, expressions, whatever we're talking about here. Anybody else?
Well, I recommend that we follow Paul's recommendation of holding off on that.
Could I get a second?
Second.
Okay, moved and seconded. Any discussion? Go ahead.
Just one quick question. We're holding off until our next meeting at the end of June, right?
Okay. Paul, is that your understanding?
Yes, that's my understanding. And we'll put it back on the agenda then.
Okay.
Okay, any other comments by anybody? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, we passed that. Paul, I do have to express concern with Dodge and Cox. I assume that's going to come back in the next meeting as well?
Yes, we have had a response from Bob Thompson, and that will be on the agenda to regarding your concerns, because, yes.
It's not on this agenda, but you know
no,
your
it's
position.
Not. It'll be on the financial agenda at the end of the month.
Anything else for Paul before we lose him?
No, that's all from my end.
Anybody else?
No. Thanks, Paul.
Okay, thanks. Good afternoon, everyone.
Okay, where are we? We're to item 6, EFI, and we're bringing 10-8 forward as well. Is that an understanding? So we're dealing with 6.
This is Greg Stump. Bob, sorry he can't be here. But he, I don't know if he had an illness, but he's feeling better and able to travel in the next few weeks. So he sends his regards. You should have copies of a presentation. And just to let you know, Greg actually has done a lot of the peer review on the valuation report, so he's very familiar with his plan. He's done a lot of the modeling, so he knows your plan. We've got a presentation, just a very few slides. This will be fast. A few slides and then a couple handouts that are sort of spreadsheet presentations. Okay. This topic has to do with the reserve crediting policy and how the reserves are credited, in particular the valuation versus the non-valuation reserves. If you look at the slide number 2, we want to talk about how the valuation versus non-valuation reserves are credited with investment earnings, and how the policy will affect the coming valuation, the valuation that we're going to be performing as of June 30th, 2009, based on the investment losses that have been suffered this year. If you remember, we brought this up before, because the way the policy is currently working, the non-valuation reserves are to some extent protected from market losses. And that protection has an impact on the valuation reserves. It makes the loss that they suffer larger because the non-valuation reserves are not affected directly by the market returns that your assets are actually earning. So we discussed this before. We said that this is probably something you should take a look at, decide whether you want to make a change in the practice, and probably something that you should decide before the June 30th, 2009 actuarial valuation is undergone. If you look at slide 3, we've got a summary of the current policy, and this is basically a summary of your excess earnings policy. So I'm not going to go through it in total. I'll just point you to the very last line. The investment losses plus the amounts necessary to credit at least a 0% return to the non-valuation reserves are charged to the valuation reserves. What does that mean? That means your non-valuation reserves, the largest one, which is your ad hoc retirement medical benefit, does not suffer if you have a negative return on your assets. So if you lost 10% on your assets, currently the non-valuation reserve doesn't change at all except for the benefit payments that are made from that reserve. Because of that, the money because your assets actually did lose 10 or 20 or some percent, in order for the non-valuation reserves to have a return of 0%, some of the assets are having to be transferred from the valuation reserves. And the way that happens is what's called with your contra account. Currently, the reserve crediting policy credits all of your valuation reserves with the full actuarial assumed rate of return, the 8.16%. But to the extent that there aren't really assets there backing them up, you've created what's called a contra account, which is sort of a negative asset, which offsets the reserves that have been fully credited with the investment return, and you're left with the actual dollars that you currently have. So when we calculate when we do the actuarial valuation, we look at the value of the valuation assets, and those are lower than the valuation reserves credited with their full amount of interest because you've got this negative contra account. And currently, that contra account, that big negative pile of money, the what you don't have, which you would have liked to have credited, that's only being applied to the valuation reserves. If you look at the first chart, current policy, there's two graphs. We show this is our projection based on an assumption that the top says current policy. This is based on an assumption of a negative 25% return on market through June 30th, 2009. We don't know what the actual return is going to be, but it's probably somewhere close to that, maybe a little better right now considering the last few weeks of the markets. But if you look at the net return on the bottom line, you'll see that under the current policy, the non-valuation reserves would be getting a 0% return in the past year. The total policy return is projected to be negative 25%. That's shown in the right-hand column. In the left-hand column, this is what would happen to the valuation reserves under the current policy. They would actually be a loss of 27.5% rather than 25% because they are supporting those non-valuation reserves. We came up with an alternative policy, which is it doesn't really require any changes to your accounting procedures. In essence, what we say is rather than just applying that contra account to the valuation reserves, you would apply it to the valuation reserves and the non-valuation reserves based on their, you know, based on their total level. And because of that, you would get a different result. If you look at the next policy that we showed, the return on the valuation reserves would be negative 24.9. The return on the non-valuation reserves would be -26.2%, and the total again is still a -25%. So it doesn't make them exactly equal, and that's because of some cash flow issues, the amount of benefit payments coming out of each fund, but it serves to equalize a lot the impact on the valuation reserves and the non-valuation reserves, and we just do this by applying the contra account to both the valuation reserves and the non-valuation reserves. I'm sorry, I know this is probably a little complicated. It's really, these are accounting procedures. The basic point is just that we're trying to come up with a policy where both the valuation reserves and the non-valuation reserves are affected by the actual market returns on the assets. And Greg has experience with another 37X system, right, where they do something.
Right. I haven't spent a lot of time on looking at your reserve policies here. Graham has. But I have spent a considerable amount of time working with San Joaquin County. Not that that's related to this, but when I looked at the materials Graham showed me for this meeting, I just basically, the reason we're making the recommendation is because what you have is an asymmetric risk where different things happen with gains versus losses. So the recommendation is really just to balance out, to make it symmetric.
And it's similar, it's not exactly the same as San Joaquin's policy, but it gives you the same result, basically, right? So that the non-valuation reserves are affected by market losses, if there are any. Are there questions on?
Yes. The current policy that we have appears to me that puts the ad hoc accounts in a higher funding priority than the vested benefits. Isn't that clearly was because when they never lose any money, no matter how bad the market is, when the market's bad, you know, the county's taking on the loss. I don't know how a policy like this ever got started. I'm just astounded, really, that something like this even exists.
We have a member of the public who wants to speak on item 6. Gary?
I'm there. I take myself off of that one because I wasn't sure where to put myself on. That's 6.
Okay. Any other board member?
Yes, I have a. Well, I'm sorry, Clarence, go ahead.
No, I think, but someone did want to have a comment.
I wanted to ask you, first of all, you mentioned when you began, you used the phrase, I think, to some extent, instead of to some extent, this isn't an accurate, or the current policy doesn't reflect the actual or a fair distribution of earnings? I mean, you used the phrase to some extent.
Well, I think it's only if there are losses where, you know, the impact if you had a 0% rate of return,
mm-hmm.
it would be the same for both the valuation and the non-valuation returns. It's only when there are market losses. And I think last year, you know, in terms of what impact has this had in the past, well, it's really only 2000, you know, your reserve policy, I think, was put into place in 2006.
Most recent.
For the excess earnings policy with the contra account. That was only put into place in 2006. The only time it would have had an impact would be if there would be a market loss, which really the only one was, you know, 2007 to 2008 and 2008 to the 2009 period. So it's really only a recent issue that it's ever had an impact. And we just want to make sure that, you know, especially for this year where that large loss is occurring, to make sure that that you're comfortable with the policy you have now.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
We use the 8.16 as an assumed rate of return to help calculate what we need long-term to fund the system, correct? So then we have a policy, an excess earnings policy, that is based on a calendar year or a fiscal year.
Fiscal
how much money we made that year.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you this question. How can you attribute any interest to ad hoc accounts if there's been no earnings?
They are attributed to the ad hoc accounts. Don't get any money if there's
they don't
if they haven't met
well,
those expenses.
Then what about the losses?
Well, and that's kind of where my question is going in terms of you say there are no losses, and I don't have an accounting background, so bear with me. All this money is still invested, though. The monies that are in the ad hoc reserves are either earning or losing. Physically, they're losing according to the market.
Right.
Okay. So I guess in terms of my understanding, and this is the accounting part of it, is the losses are just not attributed to those monies. There's a certain set amount, and that's kind of stays stable unless interest is credited to it. But again, like you said, losses are not deducted.
There's a difference between the accounting policy and the investment policy. So under the investment policy, there's just one account of money. You don't have a separate account of non-valuation and valuation assets, right? It's just one pile of money. It's an accounting procedure as to how to divide those up between valuation and non-valuation reserves. It's true that the non-valuation reserves have not been credited with investment earnings when there hasn't been sufficient earnings to credit the contingency reserve and so forth. What happens is they get credited with unposted interest. Almost the same thing that happens with your valuation reserves. Your member reserves, the employee contributions, those are credited with 8.16% return, even if you haven't earned 8.16%. What happens is, to the extent that you don't have 8.16, then there's this other reserve called the contra account, which is a negative amount, right? So if you add that negative amount plus the employee contributions with their full 8.16%, the contra account is calculated, so when you add those two together, you get the actual asset value, okay? Then there's also a split between the valuation and the non-valuation reserves. So you've got all the employee reserves, the employer advance reserves that have been fully credited with the 8.16%. But when we calculate the cost of the plan, when we compare the assets to liabilities, we're using all the valuation reserves, the employee reserve, employer reserve, plus the contra account, which is a negative amount, and that gives you to an actual asset value. Currently, that contra account is only applied to the valuation reserves. What we're saying is spread that negative asset across both the valuation reserves and the non-valuation reserves based on, you know, their share of the total assets. And then in that way, as you saw in this chart, they'll, in essence, get the same rate of return on the assets. Does that make
sense? Yes, it does.
Okay.
It does. It does. So it makes sense, and it would give us a truer view of where we actually stand in either fund.
Right.
So.
Now, Graham, the contra account, if it's negative, when we have earnings, excess earnings, then that will be used to bring back to those accounts.
Right.
Isn't that correct?
Well, those accounts still have their full 8.16%. What the contra account will do is the contra account will get smaller and smaller and smaller.
Yeah.
So in essence, the net asset value goes back to where it should be.
Okay.
So even if we didn't make 8.16 in a fiscal year, 3 years later, if the contra account is paid off for that fiscal year that we lost money, the ad hoc accounts will be credited or we get an 8.16%.
Right. Now, to the extent that you want, I mean, you could come up with a different policy where you would have the contra account could be applied to the non-valuation reserves first. I mean, that would be, you know, that would be an alternative policy, in which case, you know, the opposite would occur. The valuation earnings would get a higher rate of return than the non-valuation earnings. But again, that's a non-symmetric policy.
But right now, the valuation accounts, which are the ones that we need for payment of vested benefits, subsidize the non-valuation accounts.
Right, because that contra account is being applied to the valuation reserves.
Just so I get a fuller understanding, I'm looking at this contra account as a little bag. Anyway, so if that bag is full or overflowing, that means we're in pretty good shape. Does that mean, or there's, I mean, that means
actually, if the contra account is empty, then you're in good shape.
Okay. Think of it as a hole.
Yeah, it's more like a hole.
You take money out of that hole to fill up the valuation accounts,
okay.
And then you fill up the hole when you have excess earnings.
So we can't be overflowing on the con- Basically, I guess what I'm looking at is when we have those excess earnings that Wes was trying to get to, say we're making, as we often do, 15%. You know, that's way over the 8.16%.
Right.
So what happens once that is used to fill that contra account, but once that contra account is full, then and we still have more, or can there be more?
If you still have more, then you go back, then you look at your excess earnings policy.
Then
that's
where
your
truly
excess,
would
earnings
have excess earnings
policy kicks in. You're not going to have excess earnings for a long time. I mean, your contra account is quite large, so it will be a long time before there's not an offset to those reserves.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I just wanted to point out, with a 25% loss, the dollar impact on this is about a $30 million difference from, you know, whether that money is counted against the valuation reserves or the non-valuation reserves as of June 30th, 2009.
Do I have a motion from anybody?
The new policy you're recommending is the one that San Joaquin is currently using, is that correct?
It's similar to that, yeah.
Okay.
I can never understand how you could have excess earnings when the fund isn't 100% funded.
Well, that's sort of another question.
I would think that would be a big question. You're bound to have years where you do good and in other years that you don't. I mean, that's the way the market is. And in those years where you do better, you give it away in these non-vested accounts. Then when you have a bad year, I mean, you're crediting interest to them anyway, get to a point where the non-vested accounts can't lose.
We don't credit Jim.
Right.
On bad years.
You do it as soon as you get the money, you do.
But
that went back
through
the records.
Well, in terms of, you know, the current,
that's what does happen.
In terms of the current situation, because of the, you know, if you had from day one had a contra account policy, to some extent that sort of gets at what you're looking for, that if you had bad years, you're paying off those bad years before you have any excess earnings.
Right.
So there won't be any excess earnings from the fund because of the size of the contra account for, you know, the foreseeable future. In terms of whether or not it's about whether or not the plan is fully funded, about a comparison to the assets to the liabilities, that's kind of a separate issue, because you could have, say you had a benefit enhancement that increased the unfunded liability. That doesn't really have anything to do with the earnings of the assets. So you could have an unfunded liability that would occur for some reason other than gains and losses on the investments, which would mean you could still be in an underfunded position, but there still may be excess earnings because your investments have done well. So whether or not to base the excess earning policy on fully funding, like a comparison to the assets to liabilities, that's a sort of a separate issue of what you're getting at in terms of, are we making up for past losses before we say we have excess earnings? And I think the current contra account policy, you know, does what you're looking for in terms of making sure you pay off losses before you're giving out excess earnings. The question of whether or not you want excess earnings based on your funded status, I think, is another issue.
It probably could be a different issue. It's just a policy issue
Graham, one more question. Are the non-valuation assets, do they get credited at the 8.16% even in when we have investment losses?
They get credited with unposted interest, but they don't get credited with actual...
But what does that mean, the unposted interest? It's like, okay, we owe this...
Same way that the valuation reserves are posted with 8.16%, even if there aren't, you know, even if you haven't actually had 8.16%.
So once you got all that money and closed out the contra account, the non-valuation reserves would receive the equivalent of 8.16% for each of those losing years.
Let's say you had a return that was so great that you eliminated your contra account this year, then your valuation reserves would be equal to the amount credited with the 8.16, and the non-valuation reserves would be equal to what they were credited with the 8.16. Yes.
Yeah, well, that happened a couple of years ago when we made 16%. We kind of went back and credited that unposted interest, even in years with...
I don't have... I have to take a look at the historical crediting, but...
The papers you gave me showed.
Yeah, that's exactly the policy, and we followed the policy as it was written. That's what it said we were supposed to do, and so we followed the policy. So, yes, that's exactly what did happen.
I gave those papers to the newspaper, too, so they could understand it.
I think my issues I think there should be some formula designed to the overall sustainability of the fund before we have excess earnings. And that would be one. And then the other one would be, since we do a fiscal year measurement of whether we had earnings, I don't think there should be any crediting on years that we lost money under any circumstances. And there should be an accounting for the share of the losses in the ad hoc accounts. I'm not against ad hoc benefits if our fund is in a sustainable, healthy level. I'm not against them at all. I'm not opposed to them for retirees. I'm not opposed to them for any other methods that this board wanted to deal with them. But I think it is fiduciarily irresponsible to not stop running the meter on ad hoc non-vested benefits at the expense of vested benefits when we are in an uncertain financial status. And that's my position.
Now, Graham, what your recommendations are exactly that is to share the pain of losses.
Correct.
Okay, but is it going to also go the other way around? When we do have positive years, do we share the gains?
Absolutely.
I think it makes sense.
I think the only policy change we're talking about here, and we're getting, I think, way off the subject talking about excess earnings, because really the only thing we're talking about today is, are we going to change the policy so that the contra account also covers the non-valuation assets? That's the only. I think that's the only thing
that
we're talking.
That is the correct question. And do we have a board?
I'll make a motion that we adopt the new policy as presented and recommended by EFI Actuaries.
Do we have a second?
I would second that.
No.
Open for discussion.
Comment that I have is: are we prepared right now to make? Because there's a lot of people at this table and those that are visiting us that aren't maybe as familiar with the current crediting policy. I mean, I'm totally in favor of what it sounds like right now, what you're offering, but can we make it without seeing the two of them compared side by side to say, okay, this is what we're going to change, and this is what the effect is, and this is how it differs from our previous policy.
I think that's what you're seeing right here these two.
So the
current
first
versus,
one is the current policy.
Yeah, but in terms of, it's in words, we're talking about financial, we're talking about dollars.
Do you want it in dollars?
No,
you want it in words.
Yes. Because we have a very specific policy in terms of, okay, when this is this.
It actually doesn't take any alteration to your current policy.
So it stays the same?
All it takes is one sentence at the end that just says, the contra account will be applied to both the valuation and the non-valuation reserves.
Right.
Yeah. Just for clarification purposes, because this will determine my vote, does this new policy at all address the issue of fund sustainability, and does it address the issue of dear and years where money is lost, accounts don't get any credit for it and cannot get credit for it in the future for that bad year?
Unless there are future investment earnings that pay off the contra account,
then they get credit. Once
then everything gets everything
okay, so
gets
you
the
answer
credit.
My question.
It's basically a bookkeeping.
Right.
I call for the question, Mr. Chairman.
Any other discussion? If not, we call for the question. We went through the vote. All those in favor, can't speak. In favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
No.
Can we get those for the record?
Mike Fitch opposed, and who else?
That took care of A, small 1, 2, and 3. We'll go to 10A. If we have a member who wants to speak on 10A, do you want to introduce it first?
Sure. This is just something that we talked about before at one of the prior meetings. You still have a non-valuation reserve. You have benefits that are being paid from the non-valuation reserve. Right?
Hold on just a minute. We're being challenged and we're still on what?
Are you on 10A now?
It's 10A.
Yeah.
10. Can you finish? Do you have an item on 6 you're concerned about?
No. Graham's speaking on 10A.
10A. We've moved 10A up to follow 6. We'll move to 10A. We do have a question. Please introduce it. I apologize.
Okay, sorry.
You have a, several years ago, Buck Consultants did a study on your non-valuation reserves. In terms of the benefits that you're currently paying out, whether or not that reserve was sufficient to pay out the benefits and how long you would be able to pay the benefits out from that reserve at their current level. Given your reserve value has changed significantly with the recent board changes, and you still have a benefit level, although I don't know if it's being continued or what. If you're going to make some decisions about changing that benefit level, you may want to consider how sufficient are these reserves to pay any non-valuation, non-vested ad hoc benefit. What level, how long would those reserves last for? Now, if the amount of those reserves is really in flux, you may want to wait on that. But if we know what the non-valuation reserves are going to be as of the June 30th, 2009 date, you probably should have, we would think you would want to have some idea of what level of benefits could still be paid from that reserve and for how long. We've already started developing some software that you could use to look at, what happens if these valuation reserves didn't receive any additional interest credit for the next 10, 20 years, how long could we pay the benefits at their current rate, or we could look at, what would be the impact of a different benefit level and how long could they continue that based on the current reserve value. So it's basically just an adequacy study of the non-valuation reserve, of the ad hoc reserve, as compared to the benefit level, which you did several years ago. I think the last one was done in 2006. So that's just what that item is about.
So this item is basically to cause a study to be done?
Well, they were already in the process of doing a study because the board wanted to update the $370 a month ad hoc benefit, but clearly with the assets going down and the potential for the cessation of the benefit, it's like we're studying something that may not be around 6 months from now. So I had them pause for a minute on doing any more work on that and then come back to the board. Do we want some kind of a study? Do you want to stop? Do you want to stop doing the study at this
point? So we could theoretically suspend it for some period of time and come back and do a study later? Is the concept?
Sure. I mean, we've done most of it. I think we're at sort of the peer review stage, so most of the work's done. But if you would like to pause and wait till we have a better idea of what the asset balance are, we're fine with doing that.
Let's go to the public comment here. Lynn, you did want to speak on this?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Lynn Betancourt. This obviously should be put on hold until you guys make the final decision on health care. And that health care decision, as indicated here, could be made so that continued payments are made out of this fund and should be made out of this fund for some time into the future until the fund's empty. Now, I do know the county wants to empty it as quickly as possible to pay back their debts, but that's not really the issue. The issue is right now you have to make that decision in the near future after you get the information from RESCO. When you make that decision, it's my belief that you should reestablish this fund and pay the benefits until the fund is empty. The fund is reserved. It is reserved to pay a benefit. Pay the benefit. It's real simple. Now, at the same time, I think that when you take a look at this reserve, it was established at a time when we had a lot of income. So there's no need to continue the studies, throw money after waste.
you'll either run the money out or you won't, and it's dependent upon the market. It's really, you know, but, and the political will of the board. I'm hoping the political will of the board is to pay the benefits as long as you can. If you don't have the ability, you don't have the ability. You tried, you did the best you could. But give it a shot, please. And don't spend any more money on these guys doing that work. I mean, you did the work, they're doing what they're supposed to do. They have been asked to give their money. But don't spend any more money on that.
But he's nice. He's a nice guy.
Gary, do you want to talk on this one?
Yes, Gary Kales. And basically, it's a big deal to what Mr. Betancourt said. There are benefits here. There are funds to pay it. I feel that it shouldn't be just cut off all at once. I believe a year ago decided this came up and said, well, we can maybe downgrade it in layers. If we don't have money, we can start reducing the amount. Instead of going to just zero at once, I think the better thing would be for the board to say, okay, we're in problem now. We can continue this for X number of years, or maybe if we reduce the amount we're giving, then we'll see next year how much we can give. But that'll give many retirees who are dependent on this source for whatever reason a chance to adjust to it rather than just have it all cut off at once. But there's no need to cut it off at once. I believe a lot of the issue is playing politics. Some people do not believe that it should be paid at all. And that's a political view, and that's being injected into this board. But the board should look at that they're here to serve the retirement system and the retirees, and that the money is there. There's no reason to cut it off at once.
So at this time, we have a question about a study.
And the continuing performing the actuarial study, that's it.
I
just want to make a quick comment. I don't disagree with what you're saying, and I truly believe that. We want to take this particular ad hoc benefit as far forward as we can go, because remember, we don't just represent retirees, we also represent active employees who want to be retirees. So one of the studies that we did a few years back was to say how far we can sustain it into the future, into perpetuity, hopefully, you know, depending on what it is that we make and depending on what kind of changes are made for new and future employees. You know, that could change things, that's for sure. But in the meantime, we have the responsibility to look forward, you know, and perhaps there's a compromise we could make at some point. I don't know. But anyways, having said that, we're trying to focus on that and keeping it moving forward as opposed to giving it all away to whoever's political interest it may be.
Okay, again, focusing on whether we want to continue with a study or stop the study. Do we have any...
I'll make a motion based upon the input of the administrator that I believe, as he does, that there's no need to spend any further money on this study at this time. So my motion would be to cease it at this point, and we can always pick it up at a later date if necessary.
Do I have a second?
I'll second that motion.
Okay, we have a motion and a
second. One more question there. If you were to keep on going, how much more would this cost? Just if you... I realize you couldn't say exactly, but could you?
Less than $2,000.
I think we need to wait at least until
June 30th.
You might want to wait until June 30th.
Yeah.
At
the very least.
That'd be fine.
So we can always pick this up at any time
sure.
Previous work you've done could still be relevant.
Yeah, and the software is similar to what we showed you before with the funding policy. We can enter in a different rate of return.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so what happens if our non-valuation reserves gets this, you know, gets these values? You can do the what ifs, and you can see how long the reserve would last at the current, you know, at the current levels. But I think it makes perfect sense to at least wait until the end of the fiscal year, so you actually know what that first number is.
And you're concerned about losing the work we've already done?
That
won't happen. It's the work can be preserved and used in the future.
It's on my computer, it's on his computer.
Okay. Well, I think it was a question worth asking.
Okay, so we have a motion to suspend the study at this time. We have a second. Any further discussion? If not, I'll call for the Motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, and that passes.
Thank you, guys.
All right.
Thank you.
That's
thank you.
All we have for you guys, right?
Yep.
All right. I'm going to 7 next, but before we do, it's a closed session. Before we go to the closed session, we have 2 speakers that request to speak. Lynn, have you already said what you want, or do you want to add more? Okay.
I know when you go in closed session, you can't tell us what's going on in there at the time. And I know that you really don't tell us too much about what's going on in there, except the title. I noticed one of them in here says the title is Public Employment Title, Retirement Administrator. And then the second one is Public Employment Appointment. And I think you should reappoint the current retiree administrator. I do know that you have some discussions, concerns about a CIO, and maybe that would assist you along the way, and that may be something to consider when you're doing this, because that's a part of that job right now. You may delegate some of those duties along the way, but it's basically the administrator doing all those things. Tom is responsible for most all of the profits that were made over the many years in which this organization was number one in the United States. Not in the county, not in the state, but in the United States. He not only was responsible for that, but he was responsible for earnings that were done when he was treasurer, which assisted this county in becoming fantastically able. In fact, so able that Prop 13 kind of screwed us up. But anyway, I think you really should consider that in any performance review you might do or anything else, whatever that might be. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Okay. Wally?
Thank you. I'm Wally Morrow, retired county auditor controller in 1989. I'll be brief and not redundant. I've known Tom since he first started to work in the auditor controller's office, and I've followed his career and development over the years. I strongly support Tom, and I believe that his experience, expertise, and integrity are extremely important to RESCO, the county employees, and the retirement system, as well as to this board in helping maintain the financial soundness of the system. I strongly urge this board to refuse to accept his resignation at this time, and have him continue considering the present problems that face us. We need his expertise and experience. Thank you.
You wanted to speak on this item?
Yes, if I could.
Go.
Gary Kales. I want to thank Mr. Watson. Also, I want to give a warning to him that if he thinks that when he retires he's going to have a lot of time to relax and everything, you're wrong. You're going to be busier than you ever thought you were before. So put that into your balance of what to do. And I want to thank him and his office, because not only him, but the way he had everybody in the office working, when it came time to retire and come in and conferring with people, it was certainly a pleasurable experience the way it operated. I think his leadership led to that for everybody else. So anyhow, thank you.
Yeah, I need a motion to go into closed session.
You know what? Before we go into closed session, I'd like to say something, and with the public hearing it. Tom served on this board with integrity and goodwill for many years, and your intelligence and knowledge of the system is a strong asset to this organization. And since you took over as administrator, many positive changes have taken place. The office was in disarray. There was a backlog of disability applications, among other things, and the office now operates in an efficient, congenial manner. And you're an asset to this organization, and I feel that it would be a tremendous loss to the system if you should resign. I also want to apologize for not speaking up on your behalf when some inappropriate and mean-spirited remarks were made at the last board meeting.
Okay, can I have a motion to go into closed session?
So moved.
Second.
Okay, moved and second. All in favor, signify by saying aye. we have to have a motion to go
into
session?
Well, in the minutes, I'll be saying, upon returning to regular session at 4:20 p.m., which is right now,
okay.
So-and-so read the findings of the closed session.
Okay, so I'll give the findings in a minute, because we had the motion to go out of closed session, so that put us back in regular
session.
Exactly. And I'm just asking if anybody was left back there. Does anybody know? Okay.
As long as you have people in here.
Okay, so we're coming out of closed session, and within closed session, the board did not accept the administrator's resignation, and the administrator rescinded his resignation.
Can we clap?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. That's wonderful.
Oh.
Mentally clap.
Yes.
That takes me on to what? Item number...
Oh, I forgot I'm all about it. Sorry about that. And I spoke...
Eight. Committee report. Due diligence, Maria.
Yes.
That's item number eight. I'm going to see if I get any speakers. No.
I have the boring stuff.
Go for it.
Anyways, I did bring this up last month, our last meeting. We have scheduled for our due diligence visits this year for 2009. We have the Pyramus Capital Prospects and Luma Sales will be, I hope, done by Skype or video conferencing. So it is our attempt to save some money in terms of traveling all the way across country and back for usually a two-day visit. Paul Hart will continue to be our proxy. He will make the on-site visits. So that's one individual. We will also have a due diligence visit in San Francisco of Legato Capital and Delaware Investments. And again, Paul will do the footwork on those. And we will also meet with them, I believe, in video conference. Was that the plan, Joyce?
There
were
three in September that we were going to do. Okay.
So that's the plan for this year.
Okay, that's report on item eight. Any questions? We did item number nine already. We moved to did item 10A. So now we move to administrator 10B. Verbal report on asset rebalancing.
Just to bring you up to speed, which you probably have already heard today, that of course March 24th, the board approved the rebalancing of $55 million in assets to be sold from the fixed income, and $5 million transferred to Luma sales, $5 million to Delaware, $10 million to Legato, and $35 million to the new allocation of BGI. UBGI contract was under review, so May 28th. We appeared to be close, and so we prepared letters May 29th to effect the rebalancing. The letter stated that Dodger Cox could raise the $55 million through the sale by Friday, June 5th, in about 1 week, and then the transfers could be made Monday, June 8th. June 4th, the UBGI contract was not able to be finalized, but the rebalancing of the $20 million was transferred, and we still have the $35 million outstanding for the BGI contract. So that's the update on rebalance.
Okay, we go to C, verbal update on Reed Smith, Temporary Fiduciary Counsel, Billings.
Okay, as you know, Harvey Lederman and Jeff Rieger of Reed Smith were hired on as Temporary Fiduciary Counsel in attorney firms called Reed Smith. And when we hired them on March 11, 2009, the board said limit of $20,000 for this cost based on counsel and staff's recommendation. A billing of $8,292 was received on about April 15, 2009 for services rendered in March 2009 and paid on April 29, 2009. A billing of $24,774.50 was received on May 26 and generated a phone call to Mr. Lederman. His conversation found that he was not under the impression that there was a $20,000 cost limit for services. There was nothing in the contract that specified the dollar limit. We also found that there were some more charges, perhaps $2,000 for the month of May 2009 related to the final wrap-up of the actuarial information being relayed to board supervisors on May 15th for its action on June 2nd. Stan Sarah has not yet received the May 2009 billing from Reed Smith. Council and staff have reviewed the March and April billings and do not find anything unusual or duplicate. Billings appear to be correct. One attorney from Reed Smith did attend retirement board and committee meetings of March 24th, April 8th, April 14th, April 24th, and April 28th, and there were phone conversations and emails between meetings with council, verified actuaries, reviewing applicable transfer documents, actuary reports, policies, etc., performing legal analysis and research. The council calculated that approximately 29 hours were used to address the meeting days and about 37 hours were used in between. I plan on approving for payment up to the $20,000 authorized by the retirement board, and the overage of the April and May billing statements will need to be brought back to the board for its action at the June 23rd, 2009 meeting.
I have a question. Since we voted on a $20,000 limit, why wasn't that in the contract?
It was an oversight, really, more than anything, because it was actually Harvey who had mentioned the $20,000, and it was just an oversight more than anything.
You know,
he's
hit one of my favorite subjects.
Well, actually, the board made it real clear: anything over 20, bring back to the board.
Right, and unfortunately, when you look at how the billing came in and the dates of your board meetings, you're absolutely correct, and we didn't know until after the April 8th meeting that there was 8,000, and we didn't know until May 26th until that there was over 20,000.
But you knew there was a meter. Meterman knew there was a meter, correct?
Yes.
Somebody did.
It was expensive.
Somebody didn't watch the meter. I think they did a great job, and I was one of the people who voted against hiring him, and that was a bad vote on my part. You guys were correct in hiring him, and I think I would have gone along easily with an extension of that.
I got that.
But I think it obviously
should have been. So it wasn't managed from a business end, and it was an oversight from a contractual end. And you know, the mistake is noted.
Okay, that moves us on to item number 11, members forum. And for information, I would like to state that there's a May 4th, 2009 letter I have here from legislative analyst and director of finance to Edmund G. Brown, Attorney General Brown, pursuant to education code, etc., talking about state tax, talking about the possibility of a surcharge on taxpayers who receive more than $40,000 taxable pension income. The recommendation is to add a surcharge. And the specific example they give is a couple receiving a pension income of $160,000 with no other income and only standard deduction would pay $9,637 in regular taxes at the 9.3% rate and a surcharge of $56,750 to the state of California. I'll give you this.
This is Jerry Brown.
There's a recommendation to Jerry Brown from the legislative analyst having to deal with some people's belief that pension funds are too generous.
So let's hit the middle class again.
$56,000?
Was that a percentage?
Income.
It's a formula in there. There's a formula that accelerates it as you go up. They believe 40,000 should be exempt, and as you go above, they'll take more and more.
Doesn't that violate the tax code, period?
Well, they do have some legislative concerns that they have to take care of, but there's also explanation how to do it.
That is.
So it's a possible future action not to be effective for at least a year or so.
There's no bill number or anything like that?
It's a
LAO recommendation.
And half the time nobody listens apparently.
We can always hope they don't listen.
Well, often they don't listen to the good recommendations
from LAO. But there's a little finance problem.
What a novel question.
Yeah.
Would allow the
balancing on the backs of the middle class.
I just was shocked.
Do you see where they rank California last in the country?
No.
Other than that, good news, I'll pass it on to Maria.
Business costs.
Any good comments?
It's almost summer. Next time we meet, it will be summer. Isn't it the 23rd?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Other than that, I have no other items.
Deidre?
None.
Nope.
Nope.
Nothing, Mr. Chairman.
I only a future agenda item, and that is that I would ask that staff benchmark other 37X systems to look at the cost associated with hiring full-time independent counsel for Stansera.
Wes, go for it.
Nothing for me.
Oh.
And that's enough.
Nothing.
Nothing?